Welcome. Today is Friday, the 26th of June, 2015, and it's a glorious, clear, sunny morning here in North Idaho. Very early morning, actually, North Idaho. And we're joined from the eastern United States, where it is still rather warm and humid. And in response to the Holy Father, everyone's turning down their air conditioners, with Father Ioannis Petrus, a traditional priest and researcher. Thank you for joining us today, Father.
You're welcome, Ryan. Thanks for having me.
Oh, no problem. Now, Father, today, of course, we're going to talk about revolution, counter-revolution. Of course, we're coming up to that very great revolution that all Americans celebrate, although nomenclature's changed a bit. I don't know if you've noticed, but in the last few decades, instead of saying the American Revolution, they've decided to say the American War for Independence, as if they weren't revolting from something. And so as we get into these issues, however, of revolution, not explicitly only on the American, by the way, in case anyone's worried about an Americanist bashing session, rather, but how did you get into the study of revolution as well as the attendant occult philosophies connected with it?
Well, as Aristotle says, true knowledge is knowledge of causes. And when you see what's going on in the world and you're a priest and you care about souls, you're always trying to find what the causes of people's problems are. How did we get here? How come we don't do what we used to do? So I tell you, one of the things that really got me was in the seminary. We were in recreation and someone gave me a daily reader of Pope Pius the Ninth. And in that daily reader, they had the syllabus of errors. And I started to read these things out loud to people, just kind of saying, "What do you think about this?" And the answer they would give is the wrong one. And I said, "That's condemned." And so we all kind of go like, "Wow, that's condemned." So you realized in the seminary that, wait a minute, everything we believe today or been holding has been condemned by a previous pope in some way. It seems, at least in some way, it's been counteracted or inverted or something. So you're asking, how did we get here? So I've been looking into it ever since.
Thank you for that. And of course, today we see the onset of an active and organized movement in the culture to overturn even our basic idea of what marriage and the family are. And I'm sure at this point everyone has seen some kind of news item, fierce Facebook debate, who knows what, of Christian baker somewhere. This shop is now being shut down because they wouldn't bake a cake for a homosexual or some other thing. And that's not it, too. Lawsuits to overturn our laws, to overturn state constitutions, when even largely secular and not terribly moral people all come together and vote in referendums to say homosexuality is not good, we'll tolerate it, but we should not have homosexual marriage, like Prop 8 in California, for instance. And so, and of course, that got overturned. And you see constantly this revolution, and it's even in the church itself. So, let's start with the very concept of revolution itself. Where can we say that the revolution begins, and what is the first counter-revolution against it?
Okay, I would say that actually the first revolution is not unrelated to marriage. One could argue that we've come full circle. So the first revolution was by the first revolutionary, which is Satan, Lucifer, the light bearer. He was given somehow a test that had to do with the marriage of God with man in Christ. And so he saw this marriage with a human nature, and that he didn't settle with that. No way. And he fell. And after that, he just tried to destroy the marriage between Adam and Eve in the hopes of destroying the marriage between God and man. One could make that argument in some ways. So we have Christ and his bride, the church. The devil doesn't like that the universe was made as a palace for the bride, as Saint John of the Cross says. And so here he is revolting against that reality. So I would think marriage has a lot to do with it, but it began with Satan. He's the first revolutionary. It began really, in a certain sense, over matters of marriage. And one could also argue that, okay, well, revolution always begins in a failure to conform to God and the way he made things. I'm unwilling to do God's way. I want to do my way. I want self-determination. So you look at the devil, what did he really want? And he's like, I can reach heaven on my own. I don't need this God-man, this marriage of God with the universe in Christ, so to speak. When I say the universe, meaning that Christ is the microcosmos of the macrocosmos. All things are summated in the Christ. He's the exemplar cause, at least secondarily, of the whole universe. So in Christ, we have everything we need. And the angels even have a place in Christ in his rational part of his soul. So, you know, that unwillingness to conform to Christ is really the taproot of revolution. So, you know, if you have anything to say about that, let me know. I mean, basically, it's an unwillingness to accept the way God created this universe. It's wanting to do something on your own. It's self-determination. It wants to ignore God. It wants to forget God. It wants to save themselves. Self-determination.
So we see this movement against God and the non serviam, you know, not serve. I can do it, or put it more recently, a recent singer put it, I can do it my way.
Exactly.
So what was the, so with every revolution, then there is at least the potential for a counter revolution, and also for a worse revolution going in the other direction. So then, what is counter revolution?
Well, counter revolution would be to somehow, by God's power, obviously, restore things to the order that he established. So the devil's going to break from the order God established and try to get as many people to break from that order as he can. And God is going to set the order and reestablish and restore that order that was lost. That's the key of counter-revolution. It's restoration. It's not a new thing. It's a restoring thing. So the restoration, the counter-revolution began at Genesis 3:15, you know, with mentioning of the Christ coming to restore what had just been lost.
I believe, and I think I've heard some of your sermons on it before that are online, when God forms counter-revolution to the devil's revolution, there's a certain structure that's made that forms just like the Greek letter chi, which looks to us like an X. So it forms a chiasm. Could you talk a little more about what a chiasm is?
Yes, a chiasm, or sometimes we use our little more English pronunciation, chiasm. But it's an X-shaped structure. If we look at various literary structures in the scriptures, and even in some ancient writings, the authors would write in an X shape. So they would start with one idea, begin to go to another idea, and then it would turn and go back and use the same ideas in reverse order, such that it form a sort of X shape, with the only single thought being right in the middle at the turn point. So that's a chiasm or a chiasm. And if you look at creation, the whole created universe, the order that God seems to have embedded in it, is a chiasm. You have Christ as the Alpha, and then look at the end of the world, the second coming, and the general judgment, you have Christ as the Omega. And then you have right in the middle, you have Christ coming as man. But in between, there are various parallel structures. You have basically, you know, you can look at some of these, I can go through them a little bit. You have heaven and earth coming after the Christ as the Alpha and the Omega. And in the time, we'll have a new heaven and a new earth restored and made supernatural. After the heaven and earth are made at the beginning, you got Adam, and then Adam after Adam, you get Eve. And then from them comes the human race. And then from them comes the new Eve. And then comes the new Adam from the new Eve. And then it turns. We get the new Eve, which is the church, flowing from the side of the new Adam on the cross. And from that comes the new human race that's baptized from those waters. And then we get the new Eve. She's somehow, the virgin is going to usher in the new Adam at the second coming, and then the new heavens and the earth new earth, and then Christ as the Omega. So you get a big, big X shape for the whole created time of the universe. And that's pretty powerful stuff. Pretty powerful.
Yes, it is. And let's look at some historical examples. And of course, as I mentioned in the beginning, we are coming to the 4th of July, the Great American Revolution. And a lot of people then celebrate revolution, right? Fighting tyranny on man's terms. But so often, and it's necessary to demur for a second, that none of this means you can't love your country, for all the critical things we're going to say about the idea of revolution as well as the American. And doesn't mean that you can't even celebrate the good things about your country. I certainly don't have any, you know, don't have any issue with that with people. But there's like almost a facile feeling that, you know, whenever there's something bad, we can revolt and we can get the pitchforks and the torches and the guns and go out there and overturn everything and make it all brand new. And you see that even in the Declaration of Independence, where they say that, you know, if I should have. I didn't have it quoted. I should have had it right up. But where they basically say that if, you know, this government shall not work, men shall go and create another one, revolt even against the order we're setting up. So this is not, however, a good thing. As we've seen, revolution actually comes from the devil. And I hope to explore that a little bit as we go. So let's look at the very first point. The revolutions that brought us here today. From the conversion of the Roman Emperor Constantine, the public manifestation of Christ the king in society was gradually built up and reached its flower during the medieval period. Then something happened to change the order and nature of society, which gradually led to where we are today. So let's start about the Renaissance. What can be said about the Renaissance in terms of its continuity and also its revolt from the civilization that preceded it?
Okay, that's a very good question. In fact, I tend to look at a little bit before the Renaissance as to what brought it about. And I think there's possibly two starting points here to look at. First of all, we have to understand there's a capital R revolution that began with Satan. And then that capital R revolution finds itself coming forth from hell, the headquarters of revolution, at various times and places throughout history. And the revolution we're in now is the biggest one that the world has ever seen. And it's been going on for centuries. And so if you try to trace it back, you know, there's always been revolutions, but how did this particular one get rolling? I tend to want to think in two ways. One, it was Russia. You know, we could go back to the Russians breaking free of the Pope and out east. Okay, then they're punished for that because the Muslims rise up in the east and ultimately push the Greeks west. And so by pushing the Greeks west, the Greeks bring all their old pagan mythology and writings and whatnot, and they kind of bring a sort of renaissance, that renewal of the old pagan ways to the west. But that's after scholasticism was being rejected by the west in some ways. Now, one could ask, there's another starting point I'd like to point out, and that to me would be Martin the Fourth. Pope Martin IV, you have the High Middle Ages at the first part of the 1200s, all the way up to about Martin IV and after. You have the flowering of the schoolmen. You have great saints walking the earth in abundance, like almost like a cloudburst of saints. You have cultures developing. Everybody relates everything to God. Everything is done in relation to God. And sure, there's some wicked people around, but the culture is all being God-related. So, but by the time Martin IV takes office, Sicily is in one of its crises, and the Sicilian Vespers and all that are going on, and Charles of Anjou and whatnot, the House of Anjou is trying to secure Sicily against the Aragonese. And what I find interesting about this, and I'm not alone, is that there's a turning point took place in this pontificate. He used spiritual weapons to secure temporal ends. He used crusades and excommunications and you know, other things to force a purely temporal end. There was no moral, as far as I know, purpose for what he was doing. So you had the church abusing her authority, reaching into the temporal sphere where she should not have done that in that manner. Now, that can be done in the right circumstances, but he was doing it in a way that wasn't right, and then that kind of got carried on. And because of that abuse, we find that under Boniface VIII, of course, Nogaret, under Philip the Fair, slapped the Pope. Another turning point. So, and it wasn't long. A couple of popes later, they were in Avignon under the French kings almost, you know. So we have sort of an inversion starting. And that inversion kind of got ground, and we've got the schisms after that, the Great Western Schism, the multiple popes. And then finally, you have the Renaissance corrupting the thought patterns, which finally, all of this snowballs into what we have, the Protestant Revolution. All the other revolutions just kind of spring out of this ground like a fertile place to grow. Very dangerous. That's how I look at it. So I think the Renaissance is definitely an element of that, but not the only element. I think there's a whole authority issue, an abuse of authority by those in high office that ultimately led to this inversion.
This is true, and you see that in other places. Of course, it's funny you mentioned Martin IV. There's a saying in Italy, he loved eels. Eels,
yes.
They're one of his favorite foods, and they have a saying, "Le anguille lo uccisero." The eels killed him. the eels did him in because he loved eels so much. So it's kind of like a dictum not to eat too many eels. You'll end up like Martin.
Think about it like this. You look at the Last Supper. Our Lord just loaded the apostles with graces. They were ordained. They were at the first mass. They received Holy Communion. Their blood was mingled with Christ, commingling in a sacrament, as well as in their own veins by taking in the precious body and blood. And so they had this super high power, super abundance of grace. And then they go out and they go to the agony. And then the Lord pulls away from them just a little ways, and they fall asleep. They fall apart. They run away. They fail him. So same with the Middle Ages. High Middle Ages is like the Last Supper. They're just loaded with all these wonderful graces, super abundance. Christ pulls away a little bit. What are you going to do with all these graces? They fail him, and wrath comes upon the church, and we begin a passion. Plagues come. If you look at the early 1300s, there's hardly any saints. You've got Andrew Corsini, who is typological. He's like a wolf in his mom's dream, turns into a lamb. So it symbolizes that the clergy, the men at that time, are turning into wolves. Rather than being the lamb that God wants them to be. You got Margaret of Castello, a crippled little girl, sort of representing in a certain sense a type of the church, as it were, going through a time of like being crippled and not desirable. And then you got Wycliffe rising up, and all these guys in the Bohemia, and all these things start to come out after that schism, after that loss of authority, loss of respect in the papacy. So I don't know. I think that's one way I've tended to look at how this got started. So, I mean, wrath, Muslims, the East, pushing everything west, and now we're dealing with it. And we've abandoned the schoolmen. We can't deal with it as we should have.
Let's look at Spain now for a moment, especially in going into the late 1300s, going into the 1400s,
yes.
That you see that, of course, everybody knows that Isabella in 1492 kicked all the Jews out of Spain. But a lot of people don't know that there were, for all the innocent Jews, it had nothing to do with anything that was actually happening. And I'm Jewish myself, too, so there's let nobody detect a hint of anti-Semitism. But there were actual movements of Jewish groups, secret societies, that were unhappy with the turn of events, especially moving from Enrique de la Potente, as he was called, Enrique the Powerless, to Isabella, who started cleaning up the country and changing things, and so little different groups couldn't run their portion of the country anymore. And a lot of these groups form up with essentially Jewish secret societies. And what were these secret societies? As far as I've been able to tell, they're Kabbalah, because there's this divorce in medieval Judaism from the path of commentary and study and Aristotle and reason that you see embodying the tradition with Maimonides, for all we might disagree with him on various topics. And then on the other hand, You have the group that rejected that field of study and went to Kabbalah, to dark magic, and they were mostly in Spain, unless my research is mistaken. So you talk a little bit about the Spanish example and how that spreads after 1492.
I tell you, you brought up a very good point. Or at Spain, especially, you think, first of all, look at Vincent Ferrer. He's over there in Spain, and what's he using to help the Jews convert? He was using St. Thomas Aquinas. He was using the Summa Contra Gentiles, and he's converting whole synagogues. So, but you're right. There was a reaction, and the reaction was always one of under the table reaction, sort of a like you said, Kabbalah, Talmudic. And I do believe that's other places as well. So that brings up another point. I'm not sure this is totally connected, but Palau, good Spaniard, 19th century, Blessed Francis Palau, one of my favorites. He mentions that a perfect revolution takes on three elements, and he uses the Apocalypse chapter 13 to give us the three elements. And so he says the first element is the state being taken over by satanic ideas and revolutionary ideas and ultimately satanic forces. And so you have the beast coming out of the waters. Revolution can be modeled as like a flood coming out of the mouth of the devil, the Apocalypse chapter 12, and it floods the world. And out of that flood comes the state, ten-headed, seven-horned or ten-horned, seven-headed beast that is vicious and mean and starts to take over things, ultimately wanting to take over the church. And then you also have the beast behind that, the dragon behind that beast giving it power. That's the second thing mentioned in Apocalypse 13. And then you get an infiltration. You get a lamb, a ram with two horns that breathes forth the dragon's power, words, and whatnot to convince everybody to worship the original seven-headed, ten-horned beast. So to go toward the state rather than the church. But the lamb, the ram, is imitation of the lamb and will lead many astray. And it comes out of the dry land, not the flood. So Palau makes an argument that for the revolution to be perfect, you need three elements: a state that is not run by Catholics. It's run by seculars, and ultimately they're run by what they don't understand, maybe diabolic powers. There's an occult, rising of the occult, and then that's the dragon behind things, keeping it going. And then finally, there is an infiltration in the church. Now, I think all that was sort of coming about in Spain at that time, and they're trying to prevent it, thus the reason for the Inquisition. They saw this and they were trying to prevent it, and they did a good job because Spain became the mother house of restoration. Saint Francis Xavier, Saint Ignatius, Saint Teresa, none of these things would have been possible without Queen Isabella, the Catholic, making Spain a Catholic homeland.
Although in the future, of course, that would fall away, but nevertheless, then there's other questions here with revolution. So as we turn from the Renaissance, then we come to what's otherwise called as like a demarcation point, the Reformation period or the early modern period, because now modern historians are embarrassed even by the Protestants. So now it's the early modern period. So, and of course, with the Reformation beginning with Luther, it proceeds in a certain fashion on the continent with different pockets and groups that eventually revolt against the state. But in England, it's a little different. In England, you have a Catholic country with a Catholic king who's considered one of the most Catholic kings, very strong theologian, and of course is granted a title by the Pope for defending the faith against Luther. But then, so there was no movement from the bottom. Nobody at the bottom, except for a handful of individuals like Tyndale, for example, want revolution. You don't have any Luthers or Melanchthons, but on the other hand, you have Henry, who wants to divorce his wife in order to marry his younger, more attractive courtesan. And of course, everyone knows that part of history, but what they don't know often is the means by which Henry did it. Henry didn't do it by simply saying, okay, that's it, we're a new church here, goodbye. He crafted a whole new corpus of law, which ostensibly was there to get to nab Fisher and St. Thomas More and St. John Fisher, but the act of royal supremacy. that the king is supreme in both church and state. Violation of tradition in Magna Carta, violation of his coronation oath and everything else. But there it is. And of course, that's what are the ramifications of that revolution?
Well, there are many, and you probably could add many good things here too. But first of all, you've made a very good point in the sense that this has legalized the revolution. It's making it more legal. It's putting it in a constitution almost, as it were, you know, the act of supremacy. But I think there's another continuation here that's very interesting. Okay, you've got the fall of Constantinople in the 1450s, and you got the Council of Florence right around there that brought so many of the Easterns back to Rome. And even the Russians went home with an agreement and were ready to say, we are with Rome, but it fell apart when they got to Rome when they got to Moscow. And Moscow proclaimed itself the third Rome once they saw Constantinople go down to the Muslims. Now, that's interesting because, in a sense, that's the error of Russia that Our Lady at Fatima was speaking of, that they broke from Rome. And that's the fundamental error. And Boniface VIII getting slapped by Nogaret and ultimately being imprisoned and all that inversion that happened in Avignon and all that happened at that time is all connected, it would seem to me. So you go to Russia, it's like the third Rome. Well, Henry sort of, now he's following in the same line. He's starting the fourth Rome in his mind in England. I'm the supreme leader in here. I don't need to adhere to the Pope. I am the head. Now the state has begun to dominate the church just as it has in Russia. You have the inversion, like Palau said. You've got the 10-horned, seven-headed beast now taking charge, and the lamb that comes out of the ground that's supposed to be the church is saying, worship the state. So there's an inversion, and it's made possible in England. But it's more deeper than that. It's that England makes the revolution possible. It keeps it alive. It embeds it now in the modern world. You want to use those words. It spreads it all over the world. Many have held that the Protestant revolutions in Europe, the mainland, would have failed eventually if it weren't for England propping it all up and keeping it going. So, you know, that inversion took place there and were solidified in England.
As the revolution continues in England, of course, because there's back and forth, you suddenly get counter-revolution, where yeah. Henry, of course, gets dissatisfied with his paramour, as one of the imperial ambassadors, Chapuis, put it, and decides, sets her up on trumped-up charges that are absolutely absurd, even to the most ardent opponent of Anne Boleyn, who was never a popular queen, we should add, too. The common people had a sense of what was going on, and even the Protestants actually didn't care all that much for Anne Boleyn. But Then Henry eventually, usually historically, that comes down to Anne was, you know, as a mistress, enticing and exciting, but as a wife, not particularly compliant. And this did not please Henry at all. So then he found someone who would be more compliant, Jane Seymour, who, of course, was Catholic. And she, she plays the game, and she's helped with various courtiers to get Henry's affections. And the day after, Anne is sent to the sword, that he marries Jane Seymour. So this also inspired a number of Catholics that change was possible. So as Cromwell and Henry start going about stealing the wealth of the monasteries and appropriating it to the state, all of a sudden there's reaction in the people. The people go find their priests who are in hiding, or their priests who are just trying to deal with, you know, the status quo, and say, we're going to fight. We want our processions back. We want our monasteries back. We want you to lead us. And so they grabbed an alderman in York, Robert Aske, and they formed an army. And their purpose was not to overturn Henry and put somebody else there. Their purpose was not to overthrow the state, but to get back, to get Henry to give them back their processions, allow them again to have obedience to the Pope. And this was called the Pilgrimage of Grace.
Yes.
You see, and with the banner of the five wounds, which of course had the hands and feet of Christ, and in the center, there's a picture up on this post, if anyone is listening to the audio wants to look at it, is the chalice, with the host, and transposed over the host is the Sacred Heart. And so talk a little bit about this as a movement of counter-revolution.
Yes, and notice they wanted to restore. They also respected the king. They had a hard time imagining that the king could be so wicked as to allow all these things. Of course, they were thinking it was somebody else. And they wanted to accept him as their king. It continued. They did not want to get rid of him. They respected authority. And ultimately, it was an authoritative figure that got them to lay down their arms and give up. It was all very much respecting authority, trying to do the right thing and restore what was lost. That's why I find the Pilgrimage of Grace amazing story. I hope I got most of that right from memory, but
yes, you did. I'm sorry.
Good. Thank you. So one thing that's fascinating about it, though, is that they didn't have that. There was a wicked king, as it were, behind it, and they didn't realize that it really was him. But they were so respectful. They were so respectful of authority. They show the mark of a true counter-revolutionary, that they understand the authority of God and how it's exercised in the world, even by a wicked king. And they refused to want to go and, as it were, put that king to death. They had to give in. But I think one of the signs for me there is that ultimately there will come a time in which all these counter-revolutionary movements will find their success, because a great king is prophesied to come in the future, amazingly, and a great pope. So these men were, as it were, looking to a future reality. They were at the beginning of a terrible situation, but in a sense, they were a type. They were a type of something that's going to happen again, and it's not going to fail, though. At some point, it's going to be successful, and their blood was not shed for nothing. But now, how is the true counter-revolution going to work? Through the blood of Christ, through the Sacred Heart. That's at the heart of the chiasm of the world, the chiasm of the world is the Sacred Heart of Jesus on the cross, shedding and pouring out his blood. That's the counter-revolutionary movement. That's what makes all counter-revolution possible.
Excellent. And of course, as the situation in England continues, you still have a Catholic country with a Protestant elite in London that, of course, controls the crown. And so they determined to use the law to force everyone into the revolution. Of course, you have a temporary break with Mary, and then it goes to Bloody Bess, as I prefer to call her, unlike the way our standard history is written to call her Good Queen Bess. But I mean, the funny thing is, too, with that, it's just as a historical note, you know, with Mary, of course, she has the epithet Bloody Mary, but 2/3 of all those who were burned, and of course, wasn't burned by her directly, once the laws were enforced, and then they're enforced, and you have Protestants turning in other Protestants, because not all Protestants were the same. Some were Anabaptists, and at least 2/3 of those burned would have been burned by Elizabeth as well. People don't realize this. Heresy trials continued under Elizabeth, not just for Catholics, but for Anabaptists, for other stripes of Unitarians, and other groups that didn't conform to the Calvinist theology of the Church of England. So, and that was even true under Henry. Right, they're still doing heresy trials. Cranmer's burning people that believe the very same things he believed himself, and so the state continues in that. But once you get to James, you have a change in the monarchy, and I'm trying not to belabor this with too much history, but which creates some irritation when the Stuarts succeed to the throne in England and unite England and Scotland, and of course you have Scotland, which is a Protestant, which is a more radical Protestant country because of John Knox. It's more radically Calvinist in liturgy as well as belief, whereas in the Church of England's maintained this veneer of Catholicity in a certain sense, really just because that's what Elizabeth preferred, and that's really the only reason. So you get Charles I, who's weaker, the nature of the state is weaker, the coinage has been debased, the king's actual properties is depreciated, the monarchy can no longer run in its own purse, as all monarchies had throughout the Middle Ages. So now, in England, the only way, of course, to get more money is to go to Parliament. But Parliament has also sensed a change in the wind, okay? And so you have complaints in opposition to King Charles I's policies, even the declaration, "Let there be no taxation without representation." Right? Most people think that's Thomas Paine. Thomas Paine was only quoting from Eliot Spencer 150 years before him, who was put in the tower for not paying a forced loan. And so as things progress, you come to the English Civil War, where the king and parliament are at loggerheads, and before any negotiation can happen, there's a revolt in Ireland, where the Catholics rise up against the mostly Scottish Presbyterian plantation in Ulster, and then some Protestants are killed. This is, of course, heavily exaggerated in England, but it leads to these increased fears of a Catholic conspiracy. What do you know? The king's wife is Catholic, Henrietta Maria, for whom the state of Maryland is named, by the way, if anyone's wondering. At least ostensibly, it's actually to Our Lady, but to get royal approbation from the king, you couldn't do that. They said, "Oh, it's named after your queen, your Majesty." But anyway, so to get down to the point, there's a civil war, a revolt against the king, and then you have the two sides fighting, and then out of the parliamentarian side arises this new clique, a professional army headed by. Remember the gentry, and seconded by Oliver Cromwell, who's lesser gentry, but radically Calvinist, what they called then an independent. And under them, there's a whole branch of almost a secular Protestantism of sorts. All these revolutions inside of people now thinking, hey, maybe there shouldn't be any government. Maybe we're all equal. Maybe there shouldn't be any gentry, right? You see the Lollards, you see the Diggers, you see all these different groups that are now talking. Talk that sounds like it belongs in the 19th century and not in the 17th. And then eventually the king is defeated and Cromwell pushes for his execution, which then happens. So they have the state now, the democratic state executes the monarch. And of course, then that gets undone when Cromwell dies. There's lots of things to talk about Cromwell. I mean, it's such a, such a box to open up. But nevertheless, you have 1688 when the Stuarts are replaced on the throne, and then eventually they come down. There's all these charges of Catholic conspiracy, Jesuits, and all these things. Does it seem that we've been this way before, and that the English Civil War and its continuation in the so-called Glorious Revolution, are they the archetype of modern revolution?
Yes, I would think you're right on that. And the fear, notice the fear factor is really hyped up. And also, I would say the dialectical nature of this revolution, how one revolution has played off another revolution to get power where you want it, to level some bastion that's in the way. So revolution is always trying to level, using the French, term later coined, egalitarian. It wants to make everything level and equal. It wants to take down these things. So when you see Charles up there, it's like, wait a second, that's getting too close to what we used to do. Let's bring it down some. And they started to play forces off each other, thesis, antithesis at the dialectic to bring out a synthesis, to bring out a more democratic system, a more level, like you said, no government system, autonomous or lacking of authority. You look at the French Revolution that came later. You had the three levels. You had the States General, which was hierarchical in nature, the clergy, the nobility, the lay merchants, and whatnot. Then you had, that wasn't right. They said, well, we got to level that. And they had the National Assembly. And then, well, that wasn't right. And then they got the General Assembly. Well, that wasn't level enough. Then they got the Paris Commune. And of course, terror went along with this. So you see that same idea, I believe, that dialectical progress that the revolution wants to make is present there in England first before it started to come out in the French Revolution and other places.
So as I mentioned at the very beginning, today we have some historical spin that takes place, whereby instead of calling it the American Revolution, we call it the American War for Independence. How much was the American Revolution truly a revolution according to the principles you laid out earlier that we've talked about historically, rather than some grand experiment in liberty?
Well, I think one thing, just out of for fun, is that it was obviously adored by the French revolutionaries. Like seeks like. It's obvious there's a revolutionary element here that the French Revolution liked. We know we're in trouble. But anyway, just look at the American Revolution and what was their whole thing? It was a new order. A new order. Well, What do you mean a new order? Well, we want to get rid of the old order. We don't want anything to do with that old hierarchical church-dependent state system, church-state connection. We have to have a purely secular order. This is the first time in history you have a purely secular order. That is revolutionary. Wow. And in a sense, America is really like the baby, the darling revolutionary country. It's like the ideal revolutionary country because it was able to do so many revolutionary things without shedding blood so much. It was violent in some ways at the beginning, but not nearly as it was for the French, because the French, of course, you're toppling an ancient Catholic realm. And that's going to take some major violence and terror to turn that over, which they did. But ultimately, it's a rejection of the vertical. There's no authority over us, in other words, in America. We have self-determination, you know, autonomy. No one's going to tell us what to do. That's an American way. You know, Thomas Paine's Common Sense, how he rails against the Pope and papalism and very anti-Catholic. You look at the Supreme Court that came about later, the facade on the Supreme Court, it shows the liberty casting aside the Ten Commandments and I'm in charge now. We don't need that. We don't need the tiara, the mitre, the crown, the crozier. It's all thrown off to the side, and at the top is this Lady Liberty holding the, you know, justice. That's a sign that we are a new order. We're higher than everybody else. And also, one could argue that it was dead on arrival. The America had no vertical, so it had no soul. We would say that a country, it should be ensouled, as it were, by God through the church, and then the country is like the body. So that's a traditional way of looking at church and state, soul and body. We got started without the church. It's like we're dead on arrival in a way. And people in America, oh, they don't want to hear that. But unfortunately, it's true. Now, one more thing that I think is pretty powerful is that, as we mentioned with Blessed Francis Palau, that one of the signs of a perfect revolution is the rising of the occult. And America has continually, from the very beginning, even before the Constitution was written, has been on a magnet for occult followers, estranged people from Europe that wanted to follow occult ways, Swedenborg and all those kind of guys.
Benjamin Franklin in the Hellfire Club.
Yeah. If you look at Mitch Horowitz's book, The Occult America, he shows you all these historical incidences of a cult in America's history from the very beginning. So, you know, we have a government that ultimately is not concerned about our salvation. You know, it's not concerned. It's not going to remove obstacles to worship on Sunday. You know, a government's supposed to remove obstacles. We used to have blue laws in America to prevent people from working on Sundays and whatnot. None of that stuff. You can, in America, you can get rid of that if you want. You know, no government is going to support us in reaching heaven. That's the danger of this new order, purely secular.
Today we have, you know, whenever people talk about reform and how are we going to fix things? Oh, go back to the Constitution. Of course, that's the fix-all for everything. The Constitution of the United States is often touted as a perfect document, the font of all true reform. Yet, it contains things which, it seems to me, any true Catholic should find very troubling.
Yeah.
And then, I mean, of course, we'll talk about religious liberty and things of that nature from the Catholic standpoint, but also the Supremacy Clause. And now there's this big debate over the Confederate flag, and then, of course, all those who are more of the, it's the persuasion that, oh, if only the South won, that would have states' rights all told, you know, absent the slavery issue, which we're not going to get into. When you look at the Confederate Constitution, it was a carbon copy of the American Constitution in every way. In fact, in some ways, it was even more draconian because it set up these checkpoints at all the states. You couldn't move freely between the states without going to these basically federal checkpoints. And so So you have kind of what seems to me the recipe of tyranny all print laid out in blueprint. It just wasn't realized fully because there was a frontier left, at least seems to me. So how should a Catholic view the US Constitution?
Well, it's interesting that some of these articles and people like Chris Ferreira have pointed out it's a godless document. It doesn't mention God. How can it be good if it doesn't even mention God? So it's like, wait a second. You've seen those paintings, which are very interesting and frustrating to look at, that show our Lord, as it were, holding up the Constitution and everybody going practically worshiping this document as if it were inspired from heaven. That's blasphemy. Okay, that's a blasphemous picture because that's not the inspired word of God. But in any case, it's purely secular. It's the first of its kind. It's purely private. The religion's a purely private thing. The state is now the arbiter of truth, not the church. It's the state really finally gaining that perfect grasp over religion. It's that 10-horned, seven-headed beast able to completely subjugate religion, as it happened in Russia, as it happened in England under Henry VIII. So it's like a continuation of those things. Now, I think that people might be interested in listening to Justice Scalia. He gave a talk. He's a constitutionalist, and he gave a talk on this. It's available, at least I have it from audible.com. It was for free for those who I think are members. But he talks in there like, let's go back to the Constitution. What does that mean? Well, if you want abortion, then do it the constitutional way. So he's objecting to how abortion came into America. But given the Constitution, if you want abortion, there's a constitutional method. Follow the method if you want abortion. And that's amazing. Wait a minute. Abortion is against the natural law. It's against the Ten Commandments. It's an evil in and of itself, intrinsic evil. Therefore, it should be condemned outright, no matter what, no matter who votes for it. But it's an interesting talk in that he shows the Constitution, if you start with it, you can basically do what you want as long as you follow the constitutional method. That's bad. Ultimately, it can lead to very bad things.
And there's almost a type of that in the martyrdom of St. Thomas More coming up just a couple of days, actually, after July 4th and on the 6th of July. And More, at his trial, maintained, his silence. He didn't break in anything. But once the jury came through with their verdict, very quickly after being, pausing and looking at the judge and getting nasty stares from the judge, they came back with guilty. And More knew it was all rigged. So then, once he'd been found guilty, he said, "All right, now it's time to speak my mind." And he declared the Parliament could not give the king the title of head of the Church of England because it has no right to. It's against the law of our fathers. It's against the law of the church. It's against natural law. Even before there was England, the Pope was the head of the church, back before Englalan and the Anglo-Saxons. Even then, there's no way that the Parliament has power. And everything was in an uproar. The jury clapped, that just condemned him to death. Everyone, because a lot of people in the room couldn't be helped but agree with More's oratory. So Thomas Audley, the Lord High Chancellor, who would replace More, and of course, he's one of the few people to survive the reign of Henry, just because he was a shameless shill who would sell out his own mother if he had to. Audley got up and declared that the law of England is what the king and the parliament says it is.
Amen. That's what they do.
And that's the very archetype, the very blueprint for American law. And of course, you see it in the Glorious Revolution too, where parliament declares itself supreme. And so the king, you still have the veneer of common law in England, but that's only as long as it doesn't conflict with a new parliamentary law. And that's why you have this universal constitution. Their constitution's being created every time an act of parliament goes through. And if there's a previous law, then it's automatically superseded by any new law of parliament, regardless of its value as common law. So, and that's where, of course, the American tradition is the same thing, and our Supreme Court decisions have entirely thrown out the idea of common law or natural law. It's simply what the King of America, the King for 4 years, and the Parliament, that is the President, or sorry, the Congress, say it is.
Yes, and revolution at heart is it makes man's mind and all his devices, governments, whatever, instruments of his fallen nature, rather than a humble instrument of God's created order. Self-determination, it's Descartes, I think, therefore I am. If I think this, I'll make it so. It's whatever I want. Self-determination. It's Kant, have the courage to use your own understanding. Don't worry about all that old stuff. If you can imagine it, you can make it happen. That's it.
People act today as if, because we have the Establishment Clause in the First Amendment, that all religions therefore are on an equal footing, and the government's just a mere neutral player, right? So that the government will never do this to us because we have the First Amendment.
Yeah.
But in practice, this is not the case. In fact, in our legal corpus, this is not the case, because the government has, again, made the determination of whether a religion is properly a religion or not. And as Christopher Ferreira points out in his book, Liberty, the God That Failed, the American state is itself a counter-revolution with its own processions, its own creeds, its penances for sins, its own sacraments like voting. Its own hymns in the way of patriotic songs, even its own Eucharist in the form of the flag, which legally must be treated as a quasi-mystical presence of the essence of the American Republic and the government for which it represents it or what have you. And, you know, it's got to be legally treated as a living thing. So government is not neutral. We often think government's just neutral in any question of religion. Do you believe we can properly say that the American state, just like its Republican counterparts in Europe and elsewhere, are a non-Christian realization of Henry VIII's revolution?
I think so, and it's a continuation of the revolution he started. It's given it a home in many ways. We wouldn't be here if it weren't for Henry's revolution. But really, it's become a new religion, like you said. And it's interesting, I was just listening to the book on the life of Alfred Hitchcock, and when he wanted to make a movie, North by Northwest, and he wanted the men to climb over the faces of the presidents on Mount Rushmore, they at first said yes, and they came back later and said, no, that's sacred ground. That would be desacralizing something sacred. So they had to go between the faces. That's what they said they could do. And I never saw the movie, but that's what they were allowed to do. But interesting, isn't it? But anyway, it's a new order. It's a new order. There's nothing greater than the state. It is the mountain. It's the giant that Daniel saw. It's the city on a hill. It's the light. You must be American to be saved, it seems. We have our own crusades, too. We're crusading all over the world trying to bring about the American ideals. Interesting. So there's even statues like in Washington, D.C. that have Moses receiving the Ten Commandments, but then the Founding Fathers receiving the divinely inspired Constitution. It's like, we are it. This is it. Any religion is allowed as long as it's private.
Not to forget the apotheosis of Washington and the Capitol building. Anybody who's ever been to Washington, D.C. can see in the rotunda,
yes,
in the Capitol building, the apotheosis of Washington, and it's depicts Protestants who would never accept the Assumption of the Blessed Virgin Mary, except Washington being received in like manner, in this Renaissance Baroque type of painting, being received directly into heaven as like Christ's ascension in a certain more blasphemous way.
Absolutely. There's a whole shrine to Washington in Alexandria right down the road. So, wow. I mean, it's heavy duty stuff. This is a religion of sorts. America is a religion of sorts. And that's why people get so defensive when you say these things that are Americans. They get defensive like, you're attacking my religion.
That's precisely what it is, at least to me, is, another kid, because this church and the state properly, they have certain overlapping functions, because both have to direct men morally. The church has received God's law and guards the natural law and teaches men what they must do morally to be saved. The state, in a healthy state, has, the various things for the good order of the state, which then allow for men to work out their salvation with fear and trembling. Yet what we see today is the state has taken over that particular moral direction, and not for the salvation of men's souls, but simply for the continuation of the state and to whatever ends it particularly wants. And so that's so the two come into conflict very often, because now the church is no longer above the state, and consequently the state is above the church. And that's what people don't understand. As soon as you say separation of church and state, it's why Leo XIII calls it a pernicious and deadly error. Or no, he says poisonous error, and I'll link the reference to that in the interview notes, that he calls it an error, because when you separate church and state, you are basically saying the state is over the church. There is no neutral ground, because they overlap in their function.
Yes. There are in spheres, one's higher than the other, and there is interaction, absolutely, and overlap for the church into the moral sphere that is in the temporal realm, absolutely.
And then once the state takes on the religious direction, then, you know, it's, again, like I mentioned before, it issues penances, it has its own excommunication of sorts, it puts you in jail, you're now excommunicated from common society as its punishments and everything. But in interestingly, in England, in Elizabethan England especially, what happens as a result of the act of royal supremacy of Henry VIII? Well, penances, which used to be conducted in the church, and if you failed to observe the abstinences and you ate meat on a certain day, you'd get slapped with a penance, and so many devotions you had to get do or what have you. You got other things of that nature, and it affected you spiritually, and it was not a civil penalty, right? So not going to church, it was not a civil penalty, it was a religious and moral penalty that the community would deal with, or other things like that. When the state and church become one after the act of royal supremacy, these are now legal matters. You are now fined if you're caught not keeping if you're caught not fasting or abstaining on certain days, because it's taken over the old corpus of law and enforcing it civilly. If you don't go to church, you're recusant. They had 3 strikes and you're outlaw. If 3 times you didn't show up to take the Anglican sacrament, you went to jail for life, right? If they caught, at least that was on the books that way. And you have so many other things. The state actually took on a religious dimension, and you see that today. You now have thought crime, and increasingly, being a faithful Catholic will lead to thought crime.
Yes. Yeah, what did Lenin say? Was it Lenin? He said, if I can make you afraid of what you say, I can make you afraid to what you think. Something like that. It's very scary. Yeah. We're living in a time of renewed communism worldwide. Definitely. It's coming.
We spoke of Freemasonry a little earlier, or at least of secret societies, Kabbalistic secret societies and things of this nature in the Middle Ages. And then in the 18th century, you get a secret society that's no longer, that's formed not from a Jewish root, but actually from a Gentile root, namely from Adam Weishaupt, who, was trained by the Jesuits, admired the system the Jesuits had, and said, these guys are our enemies. We need to create a system just like theirs to overthrow them. And so, contrary to what you hear, you'll find websites where Weishaupt is establishing this Jesuit plan to take over the world. I don't know, Jesuits are about 50,000 strong in Vatican II, and now they're down to, 20,000? And it's all 60s and 70s up, so I'm not seeing quite how they're taking over the world. But, either way, every pope from Gregory the 16th to Pius the 12th, so this is 120 years, warned Catholics of the danger of Freemasonry, right? Freemasonry merged with the Illuminati, and it's mentioned by Our Lady of Quito 500 years ago, before it even began, the Masonic sect. And many still reject this as just conspiracy theory. And so consequently, every pope, Gregory the 16th, Pius the 9th, Leo XIII, St. Pius X, Benedict XV even, Pius XI, Pius XII, all of those popes must all have been these crazy conspiracy theorists. Yet they actually said that Masonry has its plan to destroy the church. What evidence do we have of actual Masonic activity directed toward the church?
Well, first of all, we have many pieces of evidence from the 19th century in the Papal Estates especially. They made no secret of their efforts to overthrow the church. They were public with it. Then they went more secret later, but one of the clearest incidences we have of the Freemasons openly trying to destroy the church is what happened to Mexico and the counter-revolutionary effort of the Cristeros. So the leaders in Mexico at that time, the turn of the 20th century and beyond, they were openly Freemasons. They admitted these things. They were known as Freemasons. So that's a sign right there that they were trying to overturn a Catholic country using Freemasonry and all that it involved. And they received many support, much support from America and the Freemasons in America. So I think that's been proven, and that alone is a sign. Another sign, I think, would be things like a common agreement. How do I put that? That's probably not the best word, but I know some bishops.
Consensus.
There's some people in Vatican II during the actual council that were pointing out that Chardin was adored and read by the Freemasons and loved. And they said we have the closest contact with the Catholics is through Chardin. So I think that too is a sign that the Freemasons, although they may not be, like you said, as organized and young as they were, they've had their effect. The revolution they started and kept going is very much alive.